that means is that the theorems you prove in your lifetime stay on after you, but no individual immortality of the soul. This is the Rambam's position. Of course, he's very careful to express it in a way in which most people will not realize what he's saying. The Ralbag, who is much more explicit on this subject, certainly believes again in the theory of the active intellect as the only thing that survives. May I remind you that the Ralbag was perhaps the last of the great Jewish rationalist philosophers, and he was perhaps the only one of the great rabbis who made significant original contributions to science. His contributions both to mathematics and to astronomy are enormous. But he was pretty well aware of the fact that what he was saying on this subject may contradict accepted beliefs. If you take a look at my page 233, I'll just make a brief quote from the chapter 14 of the first statement of the Ralbag. I won't read it all. He's a very poor writer, by the way. He's one of the most brilliant thinkers in all of Jewish history, but not a very good writer, in contrast to the Rambam, of course, who is a superb writer. If tradition demands, if traditional belief demands that the success of man, the ultimate success of man, is on some means other than the one I've just described before, namely the active intellect, the theorems that you prove are all the things that last. על זה האופנים שזכרנו מצד מה שיביאו להאמין פשוטי קצת הדברים הנאמרים בדבר גן עדן וגהנום בדברי המדרשים והגדות. If the simple-minded reading of the stories about paradise and hell lead you to believe that the success or survival of man is something else, בדברינו לא ידע באמת כי אנחנו לא נתינו לזה הדעת שניתה אליו העיון. We did not turn to our current belief, which is derived from logic, only because we believe that it can be made compatible with the belief of the Torah. And then he goes on to say, well, if your religious beliefs are so strong that you find what I'm saying offensive, stick to your religious beliefs and don't bother. But I just wanted to point out that this was a clear, consistent position. All right. So we've now gotten I just want to summarize where we're at. We have two extreme positions. The position of the rationalist philosophers. For example, I reread over the weekend Marx and Margolis and Marx's History of the Jews, and they couldn't tolerate the Ralbag. He was far too rationalist a philosopher for historians writing in the 20s or 30s of the century. And of course, as you know, one of the puns in the generation after him is that his book, which is called Milchamot Hashem, was called Milchamot Neged Hashem. So the people who couldn't tolerate rationalist philosophy sort of had the Ralbag on their enemies list, because he's one of my heroes. But the position of the Ralbag, on the one hand, is that there's no such thing as individual survival of the soul after death, so the whole idea of a soul after death makes no sense, and therefore the notion of Gilgul Nefashot, of reincarnation, certainly makes no sense. So therefore, to have any practical halachic consequences, to prefer Yibum to Chalitza because of this great mystery of the dead man's soul being reincarnated in the brother's child, is just complete and utter nonsense. At the other extreme, you have the Kabbalists who maintain that there is such a thing as the survival of the soul. That's more or less normative Judaism. But on top of that, they introduce the notion of reincarnation, which is certainly not part of normative Judaism, and therefore give a mystical significance to the act of Yibum, which makes it supreme.
So without wanting to get too far off the point, how would the Ralbag explain the unequivocal statements of the Talmud of Tchiyat HaMetzim? What would be the Ralbag's logical explanation of, you know, not only Tchiyat HaMetzim.
Let's not go into that, but let me remind you how the Rambam handles that. The Rambam has two types of beliefs: necessary beliefs and true beliefs. Necessary beliefs are those beliefs which are necessary for the populace in order to maintain the religious order. And therefore, the man in the street, probably it's good for him to believe in the individual survival of the soul in order to maintain the religious order. But the true philosopher does not accept necessarily the necessary beliefs. Right.
Why?
Yes?
Then what was his animamins then? Is that for the ordinary person?
Right. No. Exactly. How many of them the Rambam actually believed in is quite debatable. Okay, now.
How did the Khalifa
would
affect
the existence
of a way out of
it,
namely Khalifa? Why
would
they have said it has to be?
Well, I mean, you know, not every. It's just that the Khalifa for them is a very poor substitute. All right, now.
Maybe because it was done in the Ruth and Boaz.
Yeah, but the fact that it was done in Ruth and Boaz, as I explained, has nothing to do with reincarnation.
Yeah, they went through
Khalid. They went through
Khalid. Somebody else came up with
that. That's true. That's true. That's true.
Wait till it's around.
I would assume.
Then why is there no parallel for...
Are you asking me? Are you asking me to defend the Kabbalistic position? You're not going to get me.
Was that fixed number of souls created? Or is it
expensive? If you like, we can spend several shiurim on the various theories of the soul. Saadia Gaon lists about 8 or 9 of them, and he ultimately adopts the Stoic position, and it's certainly something that I'm prepared, but it's not going to be terribly exciting. I mean, all of these are going to be theories about something which we have no evidence whatsoever, right? So, the only real advances about the study of the soul have been in the last 4 or 5 years, in which we're beginning to understand the structure of how the brain functions. And I'm not the person who's competent to lecture on it. Okay. Now, this, I want to now to discuss two interesting practical cases, both of which took place in Candia, in the island of Crete. There was always a small Jewish community in Crete, numbering maybe 1,000 or about order of magnitude, certainly not a large community. But in the 14th and 15th century, they produced some of the leading philosophical thinkers of the Delmatico family. And at the same time, if we're talking about the 15th century or the end of the 14th century, Italy became, communities began to move into Italy. That is, in the 14th century and the 15th century, German and French Jews began to move into especially northern Italy. Of course, one always had the old Italian communities from the Roman period, and in the technical language of the 15th and 16th century, these communities were called Loazim. It's important for us to remember that, because when we get to the Tshuva of the Radvaz, we'll see that he is confused by that name. But then you have the community of the Loazim, the community of the Tsarfatiim, the community of the Ashkenazim, and then after the expulsion from Spain, after the troubles in Spain, which after all started in 1391 until the final expulsion in 1492, but the refugees from the anti-Semitic riots in Spain over a period of a century also moved into Italy. So therefore you had, as we mentioned last time, various different communities settling down in Spain.
In Italy. The Loazim are the old communities?
Yes, the old original Italians.
Are those the Romanio?
No, Romanio referred to the Balkan communities.
Balkan, I'm sorry.
In what we call today Romania, or in the Turkish Empire. Those were the Jews living in the Turkish Empire before the influx of the Sephardic Jews. So, one of the leading Ashkenazic rabbis in northern Italy at that time was a man by the name of Rabbi Yehuda Obernik, who was a student of Yisrael Isserlein. I checked that, for example, Melechet Yosher, which was half a generation later, there are about 153 references to Rabbi Yehuda Obernik. And he was a rabbi in Mestre. Mestre is a small town outside of Venice. If you ever travel by train to Venice, you end up at Mestre, and then you have to make your way from there to Venice. The translator of Katz's article confuses Mestre with Munster. So whoever did the translations has to know that the town involved in here is Mestre. And here on my page 231, you have a tshuva. The setting of this was a couple in Candia. This is in 1460 now. A couple in Candia, that's in the city in Crete. The widow and the brother wanted to perform yibum. By this time, the Ashkenazi custom was never to allow yibum, even if both parties were willing. And one of the itinerant Ashkenazi rationalists got to Crete at this time and engaged in a huge debate, which was first published by Danny's teacher, Mr. Gottlieb. I appended that whole article of Gottlieb here on the issue of incarnation and therefore the issue of the possibility of transmigration of the souls. And there you have explicitly a debate on the metaphysical, on the philosophical plane as to whether there is such a thing as a soul that survives the body, and is there such a thing as a Gilgul, and so on. And pressures of time, I'll let you read that whole philosophical debate yourself. It's sort of amazing that such a debate should take place in the island of Crete, and it's equally amazing that the Ashkenazic rabbi, who we normally think of the Ashkenazic community after it left Germany and moved into Eastern Europe and to Italy as being the more conservative, but by this time, by the 15th century, it was these rabbis who were tolerant of such views as that of the Ralbag, namely the rationalist philosophers, whereas the Sephardic rabbis had been completely taken over by the Kabbalah. Complete reversal as to what the situation was a century or two centuries earlier.
Maybe this is too simple, but why couldn't you just bypass Yibum and just marry, outright marry, for the widow and the brother?
Because the brother is not allowed to marry a brother's wife.
If the brother is dead?
Yeah. Question.
Even under those circumstances?
Yes. Only in the case where the brother dies childless, there's a special exception. Otherwise, it's considered a consanguineous relation. It's prohibited. Okay. So let's go on my page 231, his page 129. Al dvar ha'ish ha-mityamer la-hanhig li-yabein b'darot halal. This is referring to the practical aspects of the case that Gottlieb brings in great detail the philosophical discussion about. He says, this is a case in Crete in which a widow and a brother wanted to perform yibum. Vadai im mitzad surat deshmatin shehevi oto al zeh, if it's because of a legal discussion. In other words, if the person, the rabbi who wanted to perform yibum, based himself on a succession of legal decisions, remember in this the Sephardic decisions were different from the Ashkenazic, ein alav kolkach asha. That's not so bad. Lefisha rabu hadayot b'davar zeh. There is a difference of opinion, mainly between the Sephardim and the Ashkenazim on the issue of whether Yibun is or is not preferable, independent of Kabbalistic doctrines or anything else. V'hamatirim yeterim al ha'osrim. Those who prefer Yibum, who allow Yibum, are in the majority. Amnam im mitzad ha-kabbalah ba, but if the basis for the preference of Yibum is because of Kabbalistic doctrine, Yesh kan Hashem Gadol. Here there is a great sin. The man who chatum ala ta'anim shenotnim ba'alei ha-kabbalah. Who is the, who certifies, who's willing to underwrite all of these claims that the Kabbalists make? Umi hevi oleinu hatzara hazot la'amin lahem. And who brought us all of this trouble to have to believe these Kabbalists? Neged ha-seichel, v'neged ha-mofet choteich. Shabitel Aristo dat ha-gilgul lagamri. Aristotelian philosophy completely negates the notion of transmigration of the souls. So here it's a pretty amazing fact that a leading conservative rabbi of the Ashkenazic tradition is quoting Aristotle in order to, that is, quoting the rationalist philosophers in order to belittle the notion of the Kabbalah. The im heim rotzim la'aminu l'chit kakem b'kabbalah, if they want to believe in it, nomar lahem im chachamta chachamta loch v'latzto levadcha tisa. If you want to be smart, that's your benefit, and if you want to be stupid, you also, it's also up to you. What's the pasuk in Mishlei? Aval v'inyonei hadinin, but as far as the laws are concerned, ein mavo klal l'smoch al dimyonam b'al tamehem. There's no basis whatsoever to rely on their imaginations and reasons. V'yoter svar l'omad ha-metchila amru motzva yibum kodem l'fi yashadayin lo yodu darkei ha-motei feitu t'na'av. It makes sense to say that originally in the Mishnah when they said that mitzvah yibum kodem, it may be that they actually did believe in transmigration of the soul and so on. Chazru l'omar mitzvah chalitza kodem li'achar shisider aristo v'chilek ha-chachmot. But after the appearance of Aristotle, they realized that belief in such a thing as the transmigration of the soul is impossible. They know what is a true proof and what is a trickery and what is just winning an argument. Maybe that was one of a king. So similar to the Kalam, in other words, there have always been periods in which, like the one we're entering now, where rationalism is rejected in favor of obscure and superstitious beliefs. Kasher matzino b'sefer ha-nazir, v'gam b'zman yibuchamad hayom adabrim govrim, v'tzruchu yehudim l'mshoch achoriyem b'al kocham. V'harchein habe inyanim ba'u b'divrei v'azal, umal lanu ha-rich od b'zeh. Behinei Anochi ben Nun Hei Shanim, I am 55 years old. Zochwani Gimel Dorot Shelefanai Gdolei Olam Vukulam Heim Varotehem Hirchiku Hayibum. Vahaya Beinehem Davar Zar Vachiur Gadol Ad Shelo Nuchal Liskor Echad Bechol Hayamim Ahem Sheiniach Liabem. I cannot remember a single case in the previous three generations in which the rabbis would allow Yibum to take place. And so on. And continues to the bottom of the page, but we get a good picture of a sort of an amazing document in which the Rabbi Yehuda Obernik is willing to say that with the advent of rationalist philosophy, these superstitious beliefs, which may indeed have influenced the halacha to prefer Yibum to Chalitza, have been overturned, and don't mind if there are some cycles of reintroduction of superstition. We believe the philosophers and not the Kabbalists.
To whom was he writing?
This was addressed to the Ashkenazic rabbi who was in Crete, visiting in Crete, and objecting to the performance of Yibum by the local rabbi. And that led to a huge debate on the whole issue of transmigration, and Professor Gottlieb questions whether or not this was purely a theoretical debate on the issue of transmigration of the soul, of reincarnation, and he doubts whether it had any halakhic consequences, and of course this tshuva of Rabbi Yehuda Obernik shows that it was really a real honest case and not just some theoretical discussion. So it's an absolutely fascinating document. Now I want to come to an even more fascinating document. And that's another case that arose in the island of Crete about, I don't know, maybe 60 or 70 years later. And Okay, and this is the Tshuva of the Radbaz. So my page 239. I'm going to have to run a little bit over time, but this is really worth it. Okay. Okay, if you count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 lines down from the top. V'zeh lashon ha-she'ela. Here's the case. Yevama gedola, bat hafbeis shana, 22-year-old widow, nafla lefnei yevam katan. The brother was a minor. V'nit agna kishmona shanim. She was unable to do anything for 8 years until he reached the age of majority. She waited until he reached the age of 13 so that chalitza could be performed. When they asked him to agree to chalitza, lo ratza, he refused. V'ta'an sharatzano liyaben. He, this 13-year-old boy, said, I want to perform Yibum with this 30-year-old widow. V'im heyot sha'ana'av na'av. Since this, he was only a child, aviv natan einav b'mamon ha'isha. It was to blackmail the woman that the child made this claim. U'malameid et ha'ben b'kach. And therefore he was instructing the son, the 13-year-old, to demand Yibum in order to extract a money from the widow. A payoff. Officially, the 13-year-old boy was acting on instructions of his father to coerce some money out of the widow so that she would agree to, that he would not agree to chalitza, to performance of chalitza, until she would pay him off.
Can we assume this woman was not free to marry someone else?
That's right, that's the law.
Until
chalitza is performed, the widow is not allowed to marry someone else.
But chalitza couldn't be performed
while he was a minor.
While he was a minor.
Right, she's in limbo for those years.
For those years she was in limbo. She was willing to wait the 8 years.
Okay.
But then after the 8 years were up, he's now blackmailing the widow. Right? The father of the fact is blackmailing the widow. He was demanding an exorbitant sum. She was willing to give whatever cash she had in hand, but he was demanding a fortune. The father was trying to put the boy on a boat and get him out of off the island. Kedei la'agen et ha'isha, la'harbot alav mohar umata, in order to be able to really blackmail the widow. U'kisharau krovei ha'isha came, when the relatives of the woman saw this, halku lefnei hashrara, they appealed to the civil administration. And they referred the matter to the local rabbi. They gave the local rabbi authority to decide this case. Upasak shemitzvat chalitza kodemet lemitzvat yibum. That mitzvah of chalitza takes precedent, and therefore, va'az asru krovei ha'isha et ha'yavam ha'niskal. They put the brother in jail. They incarcerated him. Ve'hotziyu mibeit ha'asurim ad shepatra b'chalitza. They only released him after chalitza has been performed. Ve'achshav to'en sha'anus ha'yavadavav. That he did this under coercion. U'kidei latzeit mibeit ha'asurim chalatz ach lo mibilibo. Can we interpret this as an invalid chalitza because it was done without the final agreement of the brother? the custom in Candia has not been to force chalitza upon the bride. O Dilma, leka lamecha shla chalitza meusa ukshera adka. Well, perhaps we should regard this chalitza as being valid and the woman is free to marry. That's the question.
So this was similar, but not exactly the same as the case that Rashi addressed, where he said that we play a trick.
The Gemara says that you play a trick. Later on, I skipped that Gemara because my time is running short on this very important topic. Rashi says, so, but the Gemara in Daf Kuf Bob says, and the Yavama says that you play a trick.
You promise him money.
Promise him money or something.
Yeah, but didn't Rashi also say?
Rashi also said that you force. The Ashkenazi custom was to force, the Sephardic custom was to prefer Yibum. And this has enormous consequences as to the right of the widow.
And so that's a good precedent to force, there's a couple of precedents to force the brother to perform chalitza. And I'm just trying to understand that this was...
I repeat, within the Ashkenazi community, not only was the precedent to force the brother to perform chalitza when the widow did not want to perform Yibum, but even when both parties were willing to perform Yibum, chalitza was the only acceptable outcome. Whereas in the Sephardic communities, not only was Yibum allowed when both parties wanted it, but Yibum was regarded as preferable to chalitza, and therefore there was no option about forcing the Yavan to perform chalitza, except possible in objective cases where he had some horrible skin disease or was otherwise objectively repulsive. This is in Candia.
Which was Sephardic?
Basically.
Yeah, but he says they prefer chalitza, but they don't force.
All he says is that shelon nahagu ba'aretz hazot lakot lachalos. The local custom was not to force chalitza. But the rabbi did force chalitza.
She remained in her
book. So let's repeat the actual. Can I have 15 minutes more? I mean, the local rabbi acted in accordance to what would have been the Ashkenazic practice, and like I think anyone around this table put the young boy in jail until he agreed to chalitza. However, that was not the local custom of the community. And now, after the fact, the issue that's brought before the Radvaz is this a valid chalitza or not?
Who's bringing the issue? Is it the family of the boy, or is it the local rabbi who wants to see it?
Or is it just the discussion?
The local rabbi decided that this chalitza could be enforced. So the person who asked this question was either acting on the party of the father, that is, or was simply offended by the fact that the local was a religious Sephardic. But in fact, we will see that the questioner sides with the decision of the local rabbi. And the Radvaz objects. The mitzvat chalitza, he adopts all possible sides to make this woman permissible. The mitzvat chalitza kodemet, od he'elad v'nidom zeh kevan shehunar b'kofin lachlotz. Secondly, he says that even if you don't believe that mitzvat chalitza kodemet, having a 13-year-old boy marry a 30-year-old woman is enough of an objective reason to prevent the marriage. Furthermore, he says that all, in accordance with Rashi, in all cases where the widow doesn't want to marry, we force the Yavam to chalitza. Od ha'elash ima sho'el mamon k'nidodan kofim lechlotz. Certainly in a case where this is blackmail, we force chalitza. Kevan she'enom et kaven l'mitzvah, since there's certainly no intent
to perform the Yibum Mitzvah. Oh, the Afilu L'chuli Alma, Kevan Shechalatzla Muterach Linasei, Kevan She'alta Lo Tereh. Furthermore, after the fact, once the Chalitza has been enforced by the court, you shouldn't be able to invalidate it. Klala de Milta, the Lo Chashash Lach Mir Kla. So the Rav actually was asking for certification from the Radbaz. Maybe in the pocket of a poor man you can find a pearl. I pushed everything else off my desk. Then he goes on to quote the various Gemaras that we've already seen. So let's go down to the two Amin and Minayin, Levamashlaf, Emukachkin, etc., Rikulamitra, etc. Mikol Hanishmaita, the third line from the bottom. From all of these sources, Ikalamashma, the Mitzvat Yibum Kodeh, that the law of Yibum takes precedence. Umikre Malei Dibeha Katuv, the Im Loyach Botsa Ish, Lakachat et Yibim Tova, Torah Lo Tishtane, Vizman and Hezmanim, the Torah is eternal. This is a certain a rejection of Abashal's position that Mitzvah Chalitza now takes preference. For Kol Shekein, Ki Leyodim Chain, those who know the Chachma HaNisteret, the secrets, So Yibum V'Chalitza, Muva'ar Lahem Ki Mitzvah Yibum Hi Uikar HaMitzvah, V'Choshev Machshavot L'Bilti Yidach Mimeno Yidach. Certainly for those who know the truth, Kabbalistic meaning of Yibum will agree that Mitzvah Yibum takes precedence. Ba'chalitza hakanaz yu'a, and chalitza is a pure, poor substitute. V'simana chaletzmeh. Ba'ani shemati alecha ha'ach, ki kabalte mimar avi chazal, v'chein hevanti mitoch kudrus achim shehera li achi kor shumar ha-levin yu al-inyan ha-machloket shehokuz al-be-ezeh u-ktav k'nitnatu ha-torai b'ktav ha-shuri b'ktav ivri v'ani nasati v'natati b'harbe achi shariti דברי ha-ritfazal v'דברי פיית גדול חביב וראיתי ירושלמי מצח מגיל ועליתי כי לדברי כולם לוחות וישנת נכתבו השורי מתוך אותו קונטוס הבנתי from all of that discussion I understood שכבודו יש לו קצת עסק בנסתור that you do have some dealings with Kabbalistic doctrines. Ve'et hiskimu adatcha lomar ki yafeh horeh ha-morah lomar she-mitzvat chalitza kodem. How could you, therefore, a believer in the Kabbalah, accept the fact that the mitzvah chalitza takes precedent? Ve'lachein zov datzati, and tova shmo hazov bocha mizeh hadat, retract that decision and reopen the case. The al ta'ashimeni v'tachshideni shani posek halachot umureh hora al derech ha-kabbalah. Don't suspect me of rendering halachic decisions based on Kabbalistic doctrine. Ela ani machzik et ha-emet v'derech ha-emet. He's saying that I've come to this conclusion on the basis of my legal arguments, and of course as an additional icing to the cake, I'm pointing out to the fact that there's a deep Kabbalistic doctrine to all this, but don't accuse me of thinking that the Kabbalistic motivation is the primary. Okay? Even though he has no intent for the mitzvah, he may be committing incest. The Baha'i time Ma'amah Abashal the Mitzvah Chalitza Kodemet Lo Kashya Kla. That's no problem. Yibayet Eima Kra, Yibayet Eima Svar. You can either bring it from the text or from thought. Kra Dechdiv Yavama Yavor Alah Mikol Makom Vatara Asrata Vatara Hetirata Vezeh Hecher Abba Mikol Yisur Yibayet Eima Svar Yavor HaTov Yavor Mikol Makom Vias, and the good can come from any source. Ma'aseh the Yehuda Yochiyah. And the story of Yehuda will prove this. Sharei lo nitkaven lemitzvah. He thought he was visiting a prostitute. V'yatzu mimenu malkei beit David v'amelach mishichenu shigale b'mehavah v'yameinu. Etc. Gee, this is really a fascinating tshuva, but I'm not going to be able to get
nearly as much out of it as I want. You will notice that he then goes through the entire spectrum of various opinions. He then tries to understand who says what, for example, that who are the Loazim. He doesn't quite know for sure who they are. He gets a little confused as to what the country of Shum is. On one hand, we know that Shum stands for Speyer, Ramayza, and Magenza, the three main towns along the Rhine, but he quotes some sources which actually derive from there, but he's not quite sure on his geography. On the other hand, he introduces a whole lot of really fascinating principles, not the least of which is that the power to enforce chalitza, after all, if you believe in this Kabbalistic doctrine, how could there ever be an empowerment to polos chalitza, depends upon the general control of the community over all marriage laws. And that therefore, in those communities in which chalitza is enforced, it is a condition in the marriage contract that should the brother die without issue and the brother-in-law refuse to perform chalitza, that the courts have the right to retroactively annul the marriage in order and that's why in those communities, but only in those communities, can a forced chalitza be valid. Because in the communities which don't have such a regulation, then the courts don't have the power to force the brother to perform chalitza. I feel bad about not going through this whole shiva, which is enormously fascinating. Let's go to his summary. It's so long and drawn out that he himself, at the end, feels compelled to give a summary. So let's skip to that. But I urge you to read the whole shiva because it's a fascinating document, both from the point of view of his thought. After all, he was one of the great authorities of the 16th century, and how the influence of the Kabbalah really made itself out. Klali dinaktinan mahai shakla batayi. Various principles that we can derive from this long discussion. Duhu basfiru lehu mitzvat yibum kodeh. The majority of the authorities believe that yibum takes precedence over chalitza. But two, derov Yisrael nahagul yabeh. Furthermore, the majority of the customs in the various communities were to actually perform Yibum.
Where did he live?
The Radvaz was born in Spain in around 1479 or thereabouts. Of course, left Spain with a general expulsion, moved to Israel, then moved to Egypt, where he was the chief rabbi of Egypt for something like 50 or 60 years. And then in his old age, he moved back to Tzfat. I think he lived to age 100 or 110 or something like that. He was part of the court, the Mechaber, but he's certainly one of the great halachic authorities of the 16th century. So, v'tu d'rov Yisrael nahagu liyabein, v'tu d'afilu hanach d'sfir lei b'tzfat chalitza kademet, even those who believe that chalitza is preferable to Yibum, by the way, earlier on, in the middle of the Shuva, he brings Rashi's position and he says, well, Rashi was a mafarish, not a posek. And our tradition is only to follow poskim and not the farish. Right? You want to see that?
That's explaining the text while I'm deciding.
Right. Where is that? Whatever. Call from the bottom of my page 242, about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 lines to the bottom. Kol sheken sheyesh badenu klal gadol ki Rashi zal mefareshu lo posek.
V'yoteh leish yesh v'smoch al balei ha'psak. Okay. Anyway, let's go back to the summary. V'tu de'ol, all right. V'tu da'afilu haya nasui isha acheret. Even if the brother was married, ein kofin afilu v'mkalmot shepashta takanat Rabbeinu Gershom. We would allow the Yibum to take place even in those communities which had abided by Rabbeinu Gershon's takana mishum de lo takin ela le'ela pachamishi. He only did it up until the end of the fifth millennium, and the period of Rabbeinu Gershom's takana has passed, and therefore even in the Ashkenazi communities polygamy is permissible. The two, the afilu l'data omrim lakuf hani mili b'makom shenahagu. Even those who say that you can force chalitza, say that it's only in a place where there was such a custom or an explicit ordinance, furthermore, the procedure is first to try to trick him, whatever type of enforcement should be, should not be physical restraint or punishment. She got married, then you don't require it. That's the most startling conclusion that he brings. Namely, that it is possible by community ordinance to actually retroactively annul the marriage if there is a problem in the chalitza in those communities which have done chosen to do so. So even though on the one hand he is completely against the side of the woman on this issue, he opens up for us an entirely novel way of trying to deal with Jewish marriage laws and all of the current problems that we have in the 20th century, if there could only be any community somewhere which could get its act together. All right, so now this is the last year until, what is it, the middle of January. Does someone have a calendar here? Anybody? I think it's the 13th, the 2nd?
1st of January.
Right. So let's aim for the 13th of January, but if you have everybody's address? If there's any problem, I will notify Ellen by email. Okay? So have a nice vacation.
Yeah. Perform even without getting any permission.
Are there any Sephardic communities in which this position is actually persistent?
And remember, the Kabbalah is making a comeback.
Yeah, in Ashkenazi. Of course, you go to comfort.
But do you see this in
Well, I mean, in those Hasidic communities, you have this. I don't know. But you heard what Ellen just said. Yeah. The young Israel rabbis in Beitum adopts the Kabbalistic.
Also adopts the Kabbalistic.
He was very influenced by Kabbalah. He said.